ready to go, Mark?
I think I may be.
We're going to open
ruin a
the
perfectly good revenue committee.
Senate Revenue Committee. The order that we'll be hearing bills, we're first going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 863 and then quickly close that hearing.
Poor lady back there's fanning herself in anticipation.
It's getting closer to summer. We are taking no testimony. We've been advised by our colleagues in the House. We're taking no testimony in opposition to bills this afternoon. Only
just
in
to save
favor
time.
Of bills are people allowed to testify. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 863. Dick, what does this bill do?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dick Yates with Legislative Revenue. It authorizes school districts, essentially all common and union high school districts, upon district elector approval, to impose a real estate transfer tax on transfers of real property within the district. Permits the district to establish the rate and a minimum threshold by which the tax would not be imposed. Establishes uniform tax base, collection, reporting, and administrative procedures, and directs tax revenue to be deposited in a school district general fund. Takes effect on the 91 days following adjournment signing that.
Thank you. We're not taking testimony on this bill, just keeping...
I'll keep it real brief. Let's do that with all the bills.
And we'll move right into to work session. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 863. Open a public hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 13. Mr. President Pro Tem.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to have my colleague come up with me, the Honorable President.
The YMCA Man of the Year.
Is that YMCA?
Mr. President, members, for the record, my name is Len Hannon, State Senator, District 3, representing Jackson County. In 1981, the Oregon Legislature enacted Senate Joint Resolution 7 at the request of the Associated General Contractors. They referred a measure to the 82 election, and Oregonians were told, don't worry, we have enough adequate funds in the general funds to take care of state policing, and all the monies in ODOT will be used to fund highways. We took the parks and we took the state police out of ODOT funding. They were also told the same thing, interesting enough, in the 90s when Measure 5 was enacted, that there was enough money in the state general fund to pay for K through 12. And so you no longer had to pay for it through your property taxes. Just pass it over to the state, and the state can fund it with its general fund. Since that time, the state police have gone from a high water mark of 665 positions down to its current 329 positions. In a 20-year span, over a 51% reduction in personnel actually policing our highways. This is from the traffic division. I think it's important that as the House made a statement the other day by enacting a bill to refer over to the Senate to increase the speed limit, that if we are talking about increasing the speed limit, then it's even more important and critical that we refer a measure to the voters to fund adequate state policing. SJR 13 is an attempt to refer back to the voters and put into the necessary constitution the funding of state police and ODOT funding. I recognize that there will be people here from the cities and counties and Highway Users Federation and others that will take exception to this. But highway policing is a function of a highway. I'm not advocating that we fund criminal labs of the state police. I'm not advocating that we fund fish and wildlife agents. through ODOT. I'm only advocating that we refer and retain this purely to state policing of our highways. And therefore, at the proper time, Mr. Chairman, on line 7 of the Senate Joint Resolution 13, after the word prior to the word policing, I would like to see the word state included in that, so that the language would read, except as provided in subsection 2 of this section, revenue from the following shall be used exclusively for the construction, reconstruction, improvement, repair, maintenance, operation, use, and state policing of public highways. That would refrain that from being used by cities and counties for other purposes that might be used for city police, sheriffs, to fund traffic in their areas. Mr. Chairman, this is an issue that I feel it's time that the legislature speak with a loud and resounding voice to the public, that we get exactly what we pay for. If we don't want to pay for something, then don't ask for it. If we want to pay for something, and if we expect something, let's be prepared to pay the price for what we are asking for. Traffic increasing in the state of Oregon is at a horrendous level, and as we've seen reductions at the city and county level in their police departments, we have seen a substantial reduction in the reducing of the level in the state police. And for that reason, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I would respectfully request that we refer SGR 13 over to the House and out to the voters, and thus reestablish adequate state policing in our state again. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Courtney.
Thank you, Senator Deckard, Chair, and as well as Senator Bustar and Senator Charlie Ringo and Senator Tony Corcoran and other members of the Senate Revenue Committee that may be listening. I am taken by a statement I've just read.
You want him to identify?
I'm Peter Courtney. I live at 2925 Island View Drive North, Salem, Oregon, 97303. I'm a state senator, and that is district number 11. That is major portions of Salem, Brooks, Jervis, and Woodburn. Do I need to identify myself further, Chair Deckard?
We just need the cross streets. You gave the name for it. We just need to get the cross street for the record.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
It's my understanding that now that he's arisen to the position of Senate President, that he now has several doubles that walk around the Capitol. So I wondered if we could do some genetic testing, because I don't think there's any any N in his DNA.
Senator Hannon is the closest, so he would give us the best answer to that.
I'm taken by this editorial, I must have missed it, in the Oregonian way back in January 31st of this year, that says national comparisons show that Oregon has the lowest number of police per capita of any state in the nation. Now, that's just a statement, and I'll leave that out there for what it's worth. I'm also of the opinion that the general fund cannot continue to support at an adequate level the many different programs and services that it now is being asked to support. Now, I don't know how you reconcile the statement by the editorial and the statement I just made by the general fund unless you start to identify, albeit very difficult, other sources of revenue to at least support in part or totally some of these essential services and programs that I think all my fellow legislators would pretty much agree on. Unless you go to, as they say, some other source of revenue. Now, I do want to start out by congratulating and acknowledging the role that Representative Rob Partridge and Senator Rick Metzger have played, because they proposed early on a source of revenue for the state police involving auto insurance. I do not know where that proposal is as I speak to you, but they did go up the hill, I think even before we started this session or shortly thereafter, with a proposal to try to move the state police budget. Now, I'm not familiar with the particulars, whether it was the entire state police budget or part of it, nor do I know what the chances are. What I think I know we're trying to propose here is we're not talking about the state police budget, because when you talk state police budget, I believe, Senator Hannon, because you formerly were co-chair of Ways and Means and you are a budgeteer by nature, you're talking about forensic labs as well as the park rangers or the game officials, as well as what we call highway patrol. And I had hoped to come to you today, but I have failed to identify for you how many states, in effect, have not a state police force. They have what they call a highway patrol. It's an entity in and of itself. And while I'm not proposing any kind of reorganization take place at this time in this legislature regarding our state police, the good senator from Ashland, Medford area, is only talking, to the best of my knowledge, about what we call those state troopers that do highway patrol work. We are not at all talking about using gas tax dollars to support any other part of the budget. We're asking for the voters to make that decision, because we cannot make that decision, as you are well aware. I also need to point out to you, I have in front of me the ballot, the actual voter pamphlet statements that dealt with this issue twice before when the voters said no. At least it may have been more often than that, but there was a 1980 and a 2000 attempt to do this, and it failed. I think at least the 80 measure, and I could be wrong because I have not had a chance to research it, was a comprehensive attempt to try to allow them to be funded. But I'm not so sure that the last measure was, again, just to try to fund the highway patrol. So you can argue this pro and con. I just want you to know, as far as I'm concerned, I come to this because I am trying to take pressure off the general fund. So the more money can be freed up for K through 12, for human resources, community colleges and higher ed, and the other parts of public safety. That is why I'm here. I will do anything to try to help move certain services and programs out of the general fund, because I don't think the general fund, as we know it right now, can continue to support the level of services and programs that I think most of us would agree we need for this great state. With that, Mr. Chair, I will stand for your question, comments, or criticisms. Again, thank you for allowing me to come here today and speak to the Senate Revenue Committee.
Mr. Chairman, I would also like to add that if, in fact, this were to be approved by the voters, it would be my sincere desire to come back in the 2005 legislative session and specifically find specific funding through either vehicle registration, driver registration, a specific dedicated gas tax or diesel fuel tax, whatever, that would increase over its current level and be dedicated specifically for this purpose. This is an attempt to educate and sell the people on the idea first that we need to free up additional monies out of the general fund. And the economic impact that I have is estimated at approximately $75 million for the biennium. And so I think that what we're talking about here is money that the governor has proposed in his existing budget for patrol at 329 positions to be $74,140,137. And if we can come back at a future date with a specific plan in which to fund this, I think it's most important to do so.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Ringo.
Thanks for testifying this afternoon. One of the other consequences, and you did refer to it, of the change that was made in 1981 was that we no longer funded the park system from our gas tax. And I was just wondering what your thoughts are. You know, we haven't built a new park in 22 years in this state, with one exception that's currently under construction in Washington County. where shall we get money for parks?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, Oregonians passed ballot measure 66 that dedicated lottery funding for parks in the state of Oregon. So it is not as if parks have been totally divorced from the general fund without having an adequate backup source. The state police have been asked to flounder along for expecting them to do more for less.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, just a comment. I completely agree with the need to support the state police and think this is a good mechanism to do it. I just wanted to point out that there was a parks issue as well, and we did partially address it with Measure 66. So, thank you.
Chair, Dr. Senator Hannon, Senator Ringo, if I may say, the question by the good senator points out what I'm saying. He's right. Our parks are woefully inadequate, and that's another general fund type of service or program. If this kind of measure can pass, it frees up perhaps some funds that can move in that direction. I don't think you can make an argument, and I don't think you were, Senator Ringo, that gas tax money should go necessarily to the parks. I can't get there because I don't see the nexus. The lawyer in me says I've got to have a nexus if I'm going to have a chance for the voters. I think a car on a road is the nexus I'm trying to get to in terms of just the highway patrol, if I may say so. But again, it points out that you could go right. You could ask every member here to come at us about a different program or service. It's all general fund. We've got to depressurize that situation. So anyway, I don't know if that helps at all, Senator Hannon, Senator Ringo, but that's my best answer to the good question from Senator Charlie Ringo.
Senator Sharp.
Probably more of a comment than a question, but just to address the parks issue, the registration that recreational vehicles pays, does a portion of that does go to the park system. So there is, and that's where that nexus is that the Senate President just mentioned. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Warner, Mr. Botswanis.
I hope we don't cut Senator Courtney's mental health money as we contemplate this.
Where have you been? Good morning. Excuse me. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Warner, the director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. I am here to talk to you about SJR 13. Hopefully, in front of you, very shortly, you'll have a memo which is dated April 10th from myself to the committee here. And a couple things I wanted to relay to the committee, which I think are important, is that my department has safety as one of its highest priorities. It's one of my job and my staff is to make sure that the transportation system out there is safe and that people do not lose their lives or become injured as a result of driving on our state's highways, county roads, or city streets. And just in terms of background, I want to make it clear how important from the Oregon Department of Transportation standpoint it is to have an adequate policing of the state highway system. When I look at the, on average, deaths that occur on Oregon's streets and highways for the past 3 years, almost 500 people a year have lost their lives. That's unacceptable, and we all know that. When you look at the major causes of those accidents, about 201 of the 500 are as a result of excessive speed. 170 of those are as a result of alcohol consumption, impaired driving, and then about 137 or 140 of those are as a result of failure to use seat belts. And many of those can be eliminated by having adequate enforcement out there. And one of the things you've probably heard me talk about before in various committees is what we call the three E's, education, engineering, and enforcement. My department deals with the first two E's, engineering and education, but in terms of the enforcement, this is where we rely on the state police and our county sheriffs and the city police to take care of the issues I just talked about that are major contributors to accidents and deaths on our state's highways. And as you also heard from Senator Hannan, the funding for the state police has not kept pace with the growth in the volume of traffic since they were disconnected from the Highway Trust Fund in 1980. And I think you all are aware that there's many investments in the transportation system, both for improvements and just maintaining and preserving what we have today, that have also not kept pace with inflation or the demands on the system. So it's difficult to decide how to divide the current level of funding in the Highway Trust Fund between the needs of the transportation system and enforcement. And knowing that, and I believe understanding that you want to limit this to the highway patrol function of the state police, ODOT does support returning the police into the state highway fund with, as you pointed out, Senator, a specific new funding source to deal with that enforcement. They are critical to the state maintaining the low numbers that we have, and while 500, I think, can be improved, I want to stress to you that the numbers we're seeing right now in the state are some of the best we've seen since President Eisenhower was in office. So that will conclude my testimony unless you have questions for me.
Thank you.
Afternoon. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Botwinis. I'm the president of the Oregon State Police Officers Association. We're here today to testify in favor of SGR 13, and I would like to thank Senator Hannan for bringing this forward initially and today offering up the amendment to make this for state policing, because that was going to be our request, is that the bill be changed to reflect that this was for state policing only. And our thought process, quite frankly, behind that is that the state police relies solely upon the legislature to get its money. We have no ability to go out, the superintendent, and garner a citizen vote to generate more money for the state police. Cities and counties do, in fact, have that ability. County commissioners, city councils can put out measures to their local constituents to increase budgets for local law enforcement. So we thought it was appropriate that this bill would reflect to be for the state police only. And I think it probably goes without saying that there isn't any legislator in this building that doesn't understand the plight that the Department of State Police is in, and that it's been on this downhill journey for 20 years because of being basically pulled from ODOT funding. I was going to give you some numbers on my testimony, but I understand that Captain Hayes has actually more current numbers than what I have on ratios of troopers to population. But I have to tell you, just the numbers I have shows an absolute stark reality as to what's happened to the Department of State Police since it was removed from ODOT funding. And to have numbers, one trooper for roughly every 5,000 residents, to go from that to one trooper for every almost 11,000 residents is, I guess I don't understand that. That is just horrendous in my book. That should never have happened. Should never have been allowed to happen. That is not safe for the troopers that are out there doing the job. It certainly isn't safe for the citizenry and our visitors of our state, which is one of our biggest industries in this state, to travel our highways and do it in safety and expect to get from point A to point B in some form of safety. The department's been asked year after year after year, budget cycle after budget cycle, to prioritize. And I think that the department has, in fact, done that. We've reorganized, we've reshuffled, we keep trying to do more with less, and we've reached a point we can't do any more with less. We now no longer provide 24-hour-a-day coverage any place in the state of Oregon. That in itself, in my book, is a crime. That we don't provide 24-hour-a-day coverage, not in one place in the state of Oregon. So I hope that you will give serious consideration to SGR 13 with its recommended amendments and move this bill forward. Thank you.
Senator.
Thank you. In other states, are other states funded, state police funded by their highway trust funds in other states?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, to my knowledge, most other states are funded out of some form of gas tax, vehicle registrations, etc. There's not very many that are funded out of general fund dollars.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Hayes and Mr. Ledger. How are you? Should welcome Mary Alice Ford to the legislature. My eyes are not great, but good to see you, Mary Alice.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Superintendent Ron Ricker of the Oregon State Police, and Captain Hayes is here as well. He's going to give you some detail and further testimony about this bill, but I also wanted to express my appreciation to Senator Hannon and the members of the committee for their consideration of this measure. We indeed in the state police, like many other elements of our public safety system and our government, are in desperate times. But the men and women that are out there every day, and we're here today talking about uniformed patrol officers, these men and women are out there under circumstances that none of us can feel good about. I lay awake at night wondering, you know, who's out there again with no backup, no ability to get the support and have the resources they need. I would have never thought I'd see the day that we were trying to provide our uniformed patrol services in this state with around 300 people when 20 years ago, when the Department of State Police funding was removed from the trust fund, we had 665 on patrol then, and we have just over 300 now for the entire state, 24 hours a day. We have about 20 people, give or take, for the entire Oregon coast, almost 350 miles of Highway 101. As I said, these are indeed very, very challenging times. We do support and need a stable source of funding that is not has certainly not been possible in the general fund. The funding of the department's budget has been sliding backward even through the 90s when the state was enjoying its most robust economy in the state's history. In the general fund, the Department of State Police has just not fared very well. So it's clear to me, I look forward to working, you know, that we need a dedicated funding source, no question. I do look forward to working with Director Warner and our partners at ODOT as we work together, along with our other partners in public safety at the local community level, to make sure we can do the best job we can on the enforcement side of the equation, and also to be maintaining a presence out there for all other types of criminal activity that happen on our state's highways. So I appreciate the committee's consideration of this measure. I will defer to Captain Hayes and be in the room if anybody has a question for me. Thank you very much.
Afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Captain Chuck Hayes. I'm the director of our Patrol Services Division. And we are speaking of the Patrol Services Division regarding SJR 13, and I'm here definitely in support of the amendments which were discussed earlier to provide state policing on rural, state, and interstate highways. You've heard a lot of the testimony already, so I don't have to go through that, but I did provide you with some written information that I think is before you. I just wanted to talk about, again, what's happened since the early 1980s when we were removed from the highway fund. And we have seen a 35% increase in licensed drivers in the state, and we've also seen a 45% increase in registered vehicles. And you heard Mr. Botwinus talk about some figures. Well, the latest of those figures through 2001 is that we have one trooper per every 10,887 residents of this state. We also have one trooper per 11,285 registered vehicles. And that does put us in the top one or two in the country. And that's a distinction we'd just as soon not have, obviously. I can tell you that when we look at patrol troopers on the road, and you've heard the superintendent talk about this, and you've also heard that we have no 24-hour coverage, that is correct. We have offices out there that are trying to do the best that we can, and it's not always the best. On the coast, as you heard, we've got 17 troopers that are working between Astoria and Gold Beach, and definitely unable to maintain 24-hour coverage there. And on Interstate 5, which is our busiest area, we have no stations out there that are 24-hour coverage as well. So it has really put us into some dire straits and put a great demand upon us. It's kind of discouraging, too, because if you look at what happened in 2002, the patrol division made some real significant contributions to transportation safety in this state. With the troopers that we had, we actually increased our DUI arrest, impaired driving arrest, by 1,500, the highest level that we have had in a number of years. And then we ended up laying off 104 troopers. We were averaging about 110 to 120 impaired driving arrests per week with the troopers that we had prior to the February layoff. Now we are arresting about 60 to 65 per week. And that's not because there's less impaired drivers on the road. That is because we do not have the people to detect them and get them off the road. So I am here in support of SJR 13, willing to work with ODOT as well to try to make this happen. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Captain Hayes, are you, I guess worried would be the right word, or concerned that our record of referring things to the ballot has not been one that has met with a great deal of success? And ballot measure 80 is an example, a recent example, where this issue voters weighed in on. That would be a concern that I might have, that we put things that make sense to us on the ballot only to have voters tell us that it doesn't make sense to them.
Would you like to answer that? I would be more than happy to.
You're welcome to add your comment. I would offer, Senator, that we have not, to my knowledge, referred something out to the voters that was this narrowly defined to meaning just the state police patrol division funding for inclusion in the trust fund since the original date of removing us from the trust fund back in 1980. I've been around for two of those referrals, but they were not quite as defined as this one, and this one is. And I think that I would be very anxious to engage in the discussion, and I think the public, from what we're hearing around our communities around the state, we believe there is a strong public support for funding for the state police today, and I would hope that they would get that opportunity.
Mr. Chair, I would echo that as well, because of the citizen input that we're getting in my division, telephone calls literally every day wanting to know why there are no troopers on Interstate 5 or why it took so long for a trooper to show up for a crash investigation. So I think the public is well aware that we are in some we have much less people to do the job that we would like to do.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's a growing awareness. It would be, I think, helpful, although I don't know if it's feasible, to get some sort of scientific polling, and I don't know if your organization, that's usually a costly endeavor, but I think on questions like this before we go to the ballot, it's sometimes helpful to get just some temperature of the electorate. But I'd agree that I think the awareness of this problem is rising in the general public. I
agree.
Senator Farrelly.
Two comments, Mr. Chairman. First of all, to the superintendent, this current crisis in funding has caused a terrible dislocation in the Corps, in the troopers. And I've met with a number of displaced troopers, and I've seen the effect on their morale and their personal lives. And it's very difficult for me personally to see those young people have their careers derailed and to see their dedication essentially recognized but unrewarded by the circumstances that we find ourselves in. But I will tell you that those that have been displaced and have come here as private citizens to try to convince legislators of the need to find some kind of a mechanism to solve this problem, their comportment and their professionality is something that we all need to be very proud of. That's the first comment. And I've appreciated meeting some of them and establishing some personal relationships. The other thing is that even though the difficulty of losing those troopers left the duty troopers that are still out on the road without backup and in jeopardy, I commend them and you on the ability of the agency to meet its mission and keep its morale. Mm-hmm. It has not blinked or backed up, and I think that's a tribute to the training and the dedication of these troopers. So just my hats off to the troops and to you and the agency for meeting its mission and under very difficult circumstances. And I very much appreciate Senator Hammond's bringing a mechanism that I think increases the possibility of acceptance by Oregon's voters by that close connection that you talked about. People generally can make a decision to support something where they clearly see the benefit. And I believe that the conceptual amendment that Senator Hammond brings helps to make that connection. So I'm very hopeful this goes forward in a positive way. None of that really speaks to the issue of your professionality and the dedication of the Corps, which I just wanted to mention for the record. I really appreciate it.
for your comment.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Sam.
Mr. Ledger and Mr. Pinhollow and Ms. Fogue. And that is all we have for this joint resolution, unless someone else would like to testify.
I'll pass, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
We will scratch you from the list.
Hi, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm John Ledger with Associated Oregon Industries. And first, we would like to thank Senator Hannan for bringing this measure in and also the amendments with it, which we think solves the problems very neatly. AOI supports this measure. And I'm not going to speak very long because I think people have touched on just about everything. But one of the things we have also heard that people are noticing there aren't enough police on the road, on the highways. And I think it has gotten to a critical state. And it's of concern to our members for safety reasons, safety of their employees, tourism reasons. Another thing I'll just touch on briefly, as many of our members operate in rural areas where the state police are a backup for local sheriffs and city police. And so when you start losing that also, along with the budget restraints where local governments are losing law enforcement officers, it makes the whole worse than it was before by far. So with that, I'll just say we support this. If this measure comes out, you can expect AOI to endorse it strongly. We think it's a great idea. We also endorse raising more money for ODOT through other means that are being worked on now. We think that's a good idea also. And so you can count on us to endorse this if this comes out of the committee and do what we can to see that it gets passed.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Andrea Fogue with the League of Oregon Cities. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. Let me first preface our remarks with we understand that you have very difficult decisions to make this session. We understand that the significant cuts to the state police are a very big problem. What we would like to do is also make you aware of some of the other side of that, taking money out of the highway fund. This, as I think you're already aware, is an inadequate source of funding for what we need to do. Just to give you some idea, right now we're only funding half of what we need to just to maintain and preserve roads and bridges, and that's across the entire system, so state, city, and county. We have identified about $4.7 billion worth of bridge needs statewide. If you look at the modernization included, we have about $1 for every $3 to $4 that we need to spend on those types of projects. So that is also where we're at in terms of the highway fund, recognizing again that the general fund has significant problems. So we want to make you aware of those issues and also the fact that I know that the economy is a concern, and the transportation system really is the backbone of Oregon's economy, and every dollar that we are able to spend on the system translates into jobs and state income taxes. And so I'll just conclude my testimony with appreciate very much Senator Hannan's comments, his recognition that he wants to look for a dedicated revenue source for the state police and also narrow the scope of the impact to the highway fund. And with that, I'd answer any questions and turn it over to Mr. Pinhollow.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Pinhollow, representing the Association of Oregon Counties. I thank you for the opportunity to appear today with Ms. Fogue, and I would just echo her comments in our written testimony and make just a couple of additional points, Mr. Chair, if I might. We would urge the committee, as you consider this bill, to consider narrowing the scope to be more consistent with what Senator Hannan was talking about. The way it is written now, and even with the change in state police, would enable a future legislature, and I'm not questioning that this august body before us would do that, but a future legislature could dig deep into the highway funds, the existing highway funds. There's no requirement that it be from a future measure or a measure passed after the effective date of this constitutional amendment. So we would encourage you to give that thoughtful consideration, that and I believe that's consistent with what Senator Hannon was saying, that he was planning to come back in 05 and have a specific measure defined if this measure passes the voters that would provide funding for the state police. We would feel much better if you had something like that actually in the constitutional amendment. The other thing that, at least from the county standpoint, we would have an interest in, Mr. Chair, is narrowing this to the operation, use, and ownership of vehicles, and not necessarily make it available for gas taxes. We feel gas taxes are directly, and weight mile taxes are directly related to the use of the highway, and most appropriate for that purpose. If you narrowed, as Senator Hannon said, to driver's license or vehicle registration fee, those are components that relate to the driver and the person that is actually enforced, if you will, by the state police. So we would urge you to give consideration to making some additional changes to this and narrowing the scope. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Close the public hearing on SJR 13. We will do Senate Bill. The order we'll go today is Senate Bill 511, and we'll open one on 511 and 493 together, and then do 847, because I know at least one person wants to speak to both of those. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 511 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 493. And I'll turn it to Senator Ringo to start introducing us to two bills of similar flavor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Charlie Ringo, Senator, District 17. The Beaverton, Hillsborough, Washington County area had tremendous growth during the 1990s, and many other parts of the state also had tremendous growth. And that growth is very, very expensive to accommodate. During the 1990s, Beaverton had five bond levies for new school construction over a 10-year period. And that is something that is very hard for the school district to sustain, but even more than that, it's very difficult for the taxpayer to sustain. And during the campaign 2 years ago, as I was going door to door, I would be going through some old established neighborhoods, and I would talk to some people, senior citizens who had lived in the same house for 40, 50 years, and yet their property taxes were going through the roof because of their requirement to pay for all the new schools and all the outlying areas. I don't think that's fair. I think that the people that are paying for the new schools in the brand new neighborhoods ought to be the people moving into those brand new houses. And I think that's really the question here is, when you have tremendous growth and you have the cost of that growth, where is the cost more fairly borne? Is it on either the developer who's building the new neighborhoods, or perhaps the people buying those brand new homes, or should the cost be paid by people who've lived in the same house for many, many years? And I think that the answer is the former. The people moving into the new houses ought to be the ones to pay for the new cost. And it's easy for the opponents of system development charters to come and say, well, they're unfair because of this, and they're unfair because of that, and they spin hypotheticals. But I think by and large, it is much more fair that those people moving into the new homes pay for those brand new schools. And I guess the thing I'd point out and really emphasize to Senator Hannon is that I look at system development charges and the companion bill here as really a matter of local control and local option. I've talked to many people who think they don't want system development charges. And my response is, that's fine. If you don't want them in your community, don't pass them. All these bills would do is allow the local communities to utilize a funding mechanism that they want to use. And if you talk to members of the Beaverton School Board or the Hillsborough School Board, they desperately need a funding mechanism to pay for new schools. And so as we talk further about the revenue options, about local control, about paying for new schools, I would just encourage this committee to keep in mind that this is a very potent tool that would make a very big difference for my part of the state. Appreciate your close consideration of that. Just to point out one more thing, Mr. Chair, these are two bills, and I haven't spoken of them in the specifics. They would allow for imposing a cost on the new construction. They do it through a different way. There's two different mechanisms, and I'll let other proponents of the bills talk about the different mechanisms that we're proposing. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Senator Schrader, please. And Randy, do you want to come up with Senator Schrader, Randy Tucker, or Floyd? Do you... Welcome to the Revenue Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to have a hearing on both Senate Bill 493 and 511. Sign of different times. I'll be brief. A lot of this, I think, Charlie, Senator Ringo, covered fairly well. To me, SDCs and impact fees are a powerful optional tool for schools and local governments, allow them to fund services without burdening the taxpayer, and that seems to be a no-brainer to me. I think in this session, this bill is more important than ever as we have to get more creative about funding sources for critical services here in the state of Oregon. I mean, who doesn't want to vote to help schools or fire or police and then at the same time reduce your taxes? To me, this is a real no-brainer. And the people outside this building get it in a heartbeat, and I'm hoping more and more people inside the building will also get it. There are a lot of misconceptions about impact fees and systems development charges. The systems development charge is not a tax. The Attorney General in 1997, in response to some legislation that I had proposed, was able to determine that this is not a tax at all. It's merely a fee. It's used extensively in other states very successfully. California to the south and our neighbor to the north have used it to help defray significant school costs and provide quality schools for their children. Contrary to popular opinion, it does not increase the price of housing. Okay, it increases the cost, but it does not increase the price. I think any basic economics class in high school or college will tell you it's supply and demand that determines the actual price you're going to be paying, regardless of the cost. I think my own hometown of Canby is a classic example. When systems development charges came in as a result of the home builder's bill, I actually passed the bill for systems development charges, originated with them in local government. When they passed that bill, I think 1989, Canby had little or no systems development charge, very small token fees. The fees doubled. Basically, the systems development charges doubled as a result of better methodologies. In that same time period, with a doubling of the imputed costs, housing starts quadrupled. And that's because of supply and demand. Things got better in the early 90s. It had nothing to do with the actual cost of the SDCs themselves. Systems development charges do not inherently hurt affordable housing. Matter of fact, many of these bills can and are written with affordable housing exemptions. It does concern me when people talk about affordable homes in the $200,000 range. I don't consider that an affordable house for most Oregonians. So if you want to encourage affordable housing, you have a systems development charge for those that can afford to pay their cost and their burden on the school districts and on the local governments, put in their fair share, and then you have the affordable housing exemptions to encourage builders and developers to actually build that affordable housing. I think, as Senator Ringo said, this is not mandatory. All we're asking for is an option basically an enabling statute for the state of Oregon, like Colorado, California, Washington, and many other states have. There are tremendous benefits. I think growth gets beat up sometimes unfairly. I think that if new people see new growth paying its own way, particularly residential growth, and that's my thrust here. I think when I'm thinking of these fees, I'm talking particularly with schools, and I'm talking particularly on residential growth, because residential growth does not pay its way. Diversifies our revenue base. We need that worse than ever. Anyone sat through six special sessions understands that. It cuts our property taxes need dramatically. That's still an issue, believe it or not. Any one of you, I'm sure, that you talk to your citizens, most of them still think property taxes are way too high. And quite frankly, in my opinion, allows fragile seniors, and at least in my district, and some of these mobile home courts, avoid increasing taxes that are passed on to them, you know, in their rents. Because new seniors or new kids or new people moving to the district are paying a lot of the cost of the new schools. There's this other argument that's out there that old people aren't going to vote for school bonds if they think it's all coming from systems development charges. Well, that's just bogus. It's very obvious, I think, that people are more likely to vote for a bond if they know that a third or half of it's going to be coming from the growth that's paid its fair share. And there's lots of cases across the state like that. Frankly, I'll just conclude by saying it's a powerful tool for local school districts, local governments perhaps, to fund critical services that we need more than ever right now in the state of Oregon, and I hope the committee looks upon it favorably. Thank you.
Thank you. How does the exemption for affordable housing work to ensure that you keep that stock of affordable housing protected?
What we've done in the past, we've worked with the affordable housing industry, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, with the affordable housing industry and crafted it so that people with a certain income level and a certain percentage of the income going towards living expenses are those houses, those types of that type of housing would be excluded from the levying of assistance development charge. We actually are preempting the local jurisdictions from actually levying that type of fee on those that type of housing that follows it. It's like, you know, was it Title 8 or Title 9 type housing? You can work through that. It's very simple. It's really not very difficult.
In terms of the mechanics of it.
Yeah, I had buy-off in the 97 session. I pursued that extensively because there was a lot of concern by affordable housing advocates that this was going to raise the price of housing. And so I worked with them to craft language that they were comfortable with.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Floyd Brzozinski, State Representative, House District 8. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak. It sounds like a lot of the points I wanted to cover have been, and I would just want to fortify a couple. This is what you're actually being asked to do is really take part in what is a bifurcated process to just allow for communities to decide on their own at the local level whether or not they want to even impose these fees in the local community. It will be left up to each and every community within the state to make a determination if they want to expand what is already currently allowed for under state law. My concerns have been raised to a higher level based on my involvement with the Eugene Police Commission and seeing our ability to not provide the services that we need and want to be able to provide to the community, and specifically being able to have the infrastructure of new buildings, and that's what the basics for SDCs really provides for. It's not to have the ongoing operation of the different either schools or police departments, but instead it is basically to allow for the infrastructure to be put in place and allowing for these high growth areas to pay that fair share. I really see this as really a buy-in to the community. Many of the proponents will tell you that this is somehow going to hinder the ability for individuals to move into areas because it does increase the cost on the bottom line of the house. I would say that if you're moving into a community, one of the things that you should be willing to do is pay your fair share of getting essential services provided to you, and it shouldn't be necessarily spread across the board to each and every other resident of that community. Clearly, we have seen where those individuals who have paid before will be required to pay in the future for the ongoing cost of maintaining those services. But for the infrastructure of putting in new, in this case, fire department stations, police substations, or schools, I believe this is a fair way of distributing the cost for that new growth. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Ringa.
Thanks for testifying, President Brzezinski. You're from the Eugene area. Do you see this as a tool that the Eugene schools would use?
I have not spoken directly with the Eugene schools. I think that one of the other school districts that is in the area of Bethel, which is our high-growth area, the northwest area, would love to have this opportunity to fortify, because they're in the they've built three new school structures probably in the last 5 years, and they're having at least one or two more that's on the table and trying to get up and running.
Thank you.
Mr. Tucker.
Mr. Chair, if there's no other questions, I'd like to return back to my committee. If I can
speak freely. Yes, okay. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Shoot, they can answer the questions better than I can, and I'm all alone. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Randy Tucker, 1000 Friends of Oregon, thanks for the opportunity to testify today on Senate Bill. I was out of the room when you opened the hearing. I assume we're testifying on Senate Bill 511 and 493.
They're
is that
both
correct?
Open.
Okay, great. 1000 Friends of Oregon has long supported expanding the ability of local governments to recover the costs that are associated with growth. And what these two bills before you do today is they allow communities, they don't force communities, they mandate nothing, but they allow communities to recover some of the costs that are associated with new development. There are two very different mechanisms before you. I don't have a strong feeling, we don't have a strong feeling about which mechanism works best in terms of technically how they work. But it is important to remove the prohibition on local communities that currently exists communities that are growing rapidly. Right now, as you know, there is a limitation on what kinds of infrastructure can be paid for with system development charges, and there are several other kinds of infrastructure that are required when new development comes in, and we would just like to see the ability for these communities to pay for it through system development charges or local impact fees. One thing to note is that Washington and California both allow impact fees for schools, and as far as I know, there hasn't been any kind of catastrophe associated with that allowance. It's worth noting that system development charges in Oregon rarely cover 100% of the cost of the infrastructure that they're even allowed to be charged for. Most communities charge much less than the maximum or the full cost associated with that infrastructure. As I believe Senator Schrader noted, the cost of serving new development is not currently covered by the property taxes that are generated by that new development. If you turn to the back page of the information sheet that I've distributed, there's a quote from some Harvard economists that found that, quote, the available evidence shows that development does not cover new public cost. That is, it brings in less revenue for local governments than the price of servicing it. And so it's not correct to assume that new development pays its own way. And to just expand on the comments of Senator Schrader on the ability to exempt certain kinds of development, specifically he referred to affordable housing, system development charges are also currently assessed, I think, in a variable fashion for a variety of other reasons as well. One thing that I know about is that in some cases, the transportation fees, system development charges for transportation, are assessed at a variable level depending on whether development is in a transit corridor, which would mean lower transportation infrastructure costs. So there's no reason not to do something similar with any expanded authorizations that we provide under either of these bills. I'll stop there. There are plenty of other people, I believe, that are going to testify to more specific aspects or and their own concerns. So I'll be uncharacteristically brief. if that was even brief.
Thank you, Randy.
Mr. Chair?
Senoringa.
Thank you. Thanks for testifying, Mr. Tucker. Currently, the law does allow for system development charges for several things, transportation, wastewater, water supply. Is there any reason why system development charges are allowed for those kinds of things but not schools?
Well, of course, my argument is no, but I think what you'll hear from the if they testify today, the representatives of the development industry, I've heard this argument, that those kinds of infrastructure that are in the statutes now are needed before you can actually even develop the property. I think they call them leading infrastructure. And so the other kinds of infrastructure are more that we're hoping to expand the ability for local governments to assess SDCs for, are more off-site types of facilities. And so the link is, there's a clear link. I mean, you need more law enforcement, you need more fire prevention infrastructure, you need more libraries, you need more schools when your communities grow. But I believe that's the rationale that you'll hear as far as why those are not included right now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let's bring up the group. We have a group that's traveled well over 100 miles. Ms. McGosland? Ms. Oxiar? And you can just correct these when you get here, the pronunciation. Mr. Boyer and Mr. Raquel? You want to? Ms. Revel. We'll be on deck. Hi.
Okay.
Thank you for coming and being with us this afternoon.
Glad to be here. My name is Barbara McCausland. I'm here representing myself. I live at 1595 Northwest Quincy in Bend. And I have come here from a town which is drowning in development. Last year, its growth rate was 11.5%. And this far exceeds anything else, I believe, in the way of growth in the state of Oregon and probably well beyond. No town can possibly withstand this kind of onslaught to its infrastructure, and we are hurtling towards that point with great speed. Also to add to this last year, the Central Oregon Builders Association took the city of Bend to court to question the manner of its figuring SDCs for transportation. They won that case, forcing them to drop from the new figure of 3,250 for transportation SDCs down to 2,600. Plus, they managed to gain restrictions on the manner of use of that SDC. Well, I am here today to support 511 fully, and I particularly appreciate the fact that this has local option. And I want to speak particularly for schools. I was on the last school siting committee in the city of Bend 2 years ago, and we brought in a bond for $48 million, which was $10 million less than the previous bond, which supplied three schools, new schools. And we managed on that bond to bring in, with careful planning principles, remodeling and expansion of the existing schools, retaining a small high school because of its perfect transportation location, land banking, and only two schools added to that for the near future. Even with this care, we are already running behind because of this growth rate. The enrollment projections have been skewed completely, and the predictions for enrollment for 10 to 15 years out are no longer accurate. Currently, I'm paying 35% of my tax bill on three school bonds, and I have the feeling that Bend very shortly is going to refuse to pay any more on school bonds. Redmond itself has already turned down a bond twice this last year. I think asking developers to pay for the full impact of growth on our infrastructure is not at all unreasonable, considering growth's extreme burden on our existing residents, as well as straining all of our public services. It is high time to get fire prevention, schools, police, and libraries under the same umbrella as transportation, water, and waste services. I ask that you pass this most necessary legislation out of committee and onto the floor of the Senate for a positive vote. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am Janice Oxier. I also live in Bend, and I'm here perhaps to speak on the part of a senior citizen on a fixed income. As Mr. Ringo mentioned, it is a burden that is befalling us to support the growth of these taxes on us. An example, I thought maybe if I gave you an example, besides our growth of 11.5% that we're now experiencing in Bend, it's projected that this will continue in the future at the same rate probably. So the additional services that are necessary are being paid for by the current residents. This is an example of what happened to our property tax, as Ms. McCausland just mentioned. My figure was 38% that our property tax bill increased because of the schools, the new schools. That this is for schools only. It doesn't include community college, libraries, fire, or other services, but for schools only, an increase of 38% in the last 10 years. And even with this money that the school bonds have generated, we see that in 2005, we will be 513 students over capacity, and by 2010, we'll be 2,654 students over capacity. So obviously, there are going to be more bonds just to keep up. Now, personally, my husband and I have never voted against a school bond. We've never voted against a library bond. But the time is coming where I guess maybe we realize that we are subsidizing growth. And until the people that are benefiting from growth and the new people in the city pay a portion of their fair share, I'm afraid there's going to be a tax revolt, and we're not going to continue to support our schools. So this is, we care desperately about our schools. We have two grandchildren in public schools. I think that SB 511 is a wonderful solution, and for all the reasons that have been stated here. So I would urge you to get it onto the floor for a vote. Thank you very much.
My name is Rob Revel, and I'm testifying on behalf of Jim Clinton. I believe you have his statement, who couldn't get here today. Bend, as you know, has the highest growth rate in the state, and we're getting hit the hardest for paying for facilities for all this new growth. It seems only fair and economically feasible that that new growth should pay for more of its own way. Bend Schools just announced drastic reductions caused by budget shortfall. And then taxpayers paid $10 million each for new elementary schools, $14 million for a middle school, and $30 million for a new high school. New houses needing new schools cost an average of $12,000 to $14,000 per house. If new houses paid a portion of this, fewer teachers would be laid off. The Bend Police Department needs millions more in the next few years to maintain similar service levels. Now we have a new, bigger police station, which paid for out of the same budget that pays officers. Similarly, the Bend Fire Department, which has increasing response time due to the shortage of firefighters and ambulance personnel, and they have five new fire stations. They're also their costs are also increasing, and as with more development. Cities and school districts need the option to allow SDCs for part of the cost of school and public safety facilities. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Comments? Thank you for traveling quite a ways to be with us. I hope the passes are free and clear.
They are.
They are.
I hope you have studs.
I'm number four here. but my name is William Boyer, and I'm chairman of Friends of Deschutes County, which is affiliated with Thousand Friends of Oregon. And we have about 200 members, and we've placed school SDCs as a top priority for the last 3 years. And so to assure that the schools are funded, we're very pleased that these proposals are being made, and we support both of these bills. Those school SDCs are important for the entire state. Areas of fast growth, such as Central Oregon, are especially in need as development produces rapid expansion while school construction lags behind. Now, the Redmond School District is really Exhibit A. The area is expanding more rapidly than any place in the state, and the lack of school space is really extreme. Yet residents often do not pass school bonds since they are already paying high property taxes, and they increasingly know that the money for school expansion should be coming from new development. The principle that new development should take responsibility for the impacts imposed on a community has progressed in the last decade. People are beginning to understand that. But the most important impacts, funds for school expansion, has been omitted from charges that local communities can make, and that's why we are focusing on this problem today. Many people do not understand that responsibility for operation of schools comes from taxes on the public. It's a separate way of dealing with the schools. But when new development results in the need for building new schools, the established tax system is not the legitimate nor the proper vehicle for creating the schools. So bonds have previously been used to create new schools because the principle of responsibility for new development has not previously been understood very much by the public. Our only criticism is that on your Senate Bill 493, you place restrictions on communities and prevent them from deciding how much to charge on school SDCs. The mistake is to once again deny communities the opportunity to assess their own appropriate fee levels. At this time of economic stress in the state, the school SDCs, which are not legally a tax, and I want to make a point out of that, the school SDCs are not legally a tax, are one of the best ways to meet the need for new schools. Many legislators have been elected on a commitment to support education, and this is a chance to serve that commitment. We hope you will pursue this bill through the legislative process, and it will be a historical achievement for communities and for students in this state. So thank you for introducing these bills.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
I just want to thank all of you for coming from Bend, and it really illustrates that, you know, I presented this in terms of a problem for Beaverton, Hillsborough, Washington County, but it is a statewide problem for all communities that have high growth. So I just appreciate you coming and testifying.
I'm an educator, and this is one of the best things you can do currently for students.
Yeah.
Thank you. We have about 30 minutes left for our hearing. We have another bill to get to, so we're going to go about 15 more on this. We have a long list of folks to testify. If we could keep it very brief and
get to another bill.
Do only points that haven't been made previously, if possible.
Can you go to, like, Beaverton High School?
Mr. Long, Mr. Gaynor, Don, and Lori, do you want to come up with this panel?
My name is Jim Long from North Plains. Thank you for the opportunity to present today. Senator Starr, who sponsored the bill, had been in the past my senator, but with redistricting, I've got a different one. I support Senate Bill 511 on behalf of the Friends of North Plains. The Friends of North Plains has seen tremendous growth. North Plains has grown about 90% during the 1990s. This has put a great toll. North Plains, the city itself, has a lot of people on fixed incomes, and the resulting charges and increases in fees that they have to deal with as a result of growth are putting a burden on them.
I don't want to echo a lot of what everybody else has said. I just want to say that it would be really valuable to have this bill. I'm concerned about affordable housing. I think if there's local control and allowed local officials to make the decisions, that would be very helpful. I think I'm just going to leave it at that.
Thank
be
you.
Very supportive of the bill.
Thank you.
My name is Don Gaynor. I'm from Beaverton, Oregon. I'm not going to repeat a lot that was said earlier. I'd like to make a couple of points. I'm a business owner and a parent in Beaverton. I moved to Beaverton specifically because of the quality of the schools and decided to locate my business there. Have been there since 1989. There has been consistent support for as growth has occurred for bond measures. And I serve as a treasurer for the Citizens for School Support. We traditionally support the bond measures to build schools in Beaverton. What we find, though, is because of the new restrictions on bonds, when we can have elections. Last time we went out for a bond measure, we didn't get it passed, not because we didn't have support from the community. We had more than 60%, but we only had 49% turnout at the election. So we had to wait for the next election, and that gets expensive. It's also very time-consuming. Our schools become more and more overcrowded as this occurs, and we would like to see this as a tool that we can add. We're now having our group is now working on an operating levy. We haven't had one in the past, but. It's the only way we're going to be able to prevent having to cut $35 million. We'll only have to cut $20 million out of our school budget this next year if we can get this levy passed. So we're working on that right now. We're very concerned about the quality of the schools and also other services in the community. One of the things that was mentioned earlier is that California and Washington both allow for schools SDCs. There are many, many other states that allow for all these other types of SDCs, and those include Utah, Arizona, Colorado, Florida, Arkansas, Georgia, Ohio, Vermont, New Hampshire, and there are probably some others. So this is not at all an uncommon method for raising money for facilities. They're needed to serve growth. If it wasn't for growth, they wouldn't be needed. I'll just leave it at that, and I encourage your support.
Thank you very much, Don.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Mr. Chair and committee members, for the record, Lori Wimmer Whalen with the Oregon Education Association, representing 44,000 members, and we too offer our support for both Senate Bill 511 and 493. I'd like to thank Senators Charles Starr, Ringo, and Schrader, and Representative Greenlick for bringing the bills, and also to you, Mr. Chair, for agreeing to hear them. And we do certainly hope there will also be a work session to follow so that one of these bills can have a chance at life. Our reason for supporting this concept for the last four sessions is that we believe that this is a fair way to create a mechanism for funding the high growth and capacity needs of schools in certain areas of the state. As you know, we're struggling in some places to keep up with the growth pressures in those school districts that are experiencing high growth, and this offers a mechanism of making that happen or supporting the efforts to make that happen without negatively impacting other school districts, as some other of the proposals would have by thinning the state school fund soup. We believe that citizens tend to support user fees and pay-as-you-go concepts. They find that palatable. They find it intuitively that it makes sense. And because capital funds can come from those who are the beneficiaries of development and growth and for whom in the main most of the new schools must be built, we think SDCs fit that bill, therefore. So while the nexus is not perfect, nothing is. I would submit, for example, that parks are allowed to have SDCs. Though the neighborhood certainly benefits, especially from a park, others may use that park as well, but still you can have SDCs for parks. Schools at least fit in that same category, and so there is a logic to it. Finally, we think it's unfair, as others have mentioned, to pre-existing community members to shoulder all the burdens of that growth, though all benefit from the wealth of a growth community. For that reason, we ask that you do give this a work session and send it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. We have a number of folks left to testify, none in opposition, all in support of this bill. So we just only ask that folks only make points at this point that have not been made. Mr. Dennis, Mr. Conkling, and Mr. Stedman.
Mr. Chair.
Hello.
Hey, Ed Dennis. For the record, I'm the Chief of Staff for the Superintendent of Public Instruction. I'm here to express her support. That point hadn't been made for these two bills. And for myself, and then I'm going to now put a little bit of a different hat on. For myself, as a parent and a city council member in Hillsborough, I believe we need this option. I've been to three community meetings so far this week, and I've got two more to go. The first one, 50 parents and teachers. The second one, 300. The third one, over 500. And tomorrow, I expect at least the same. And on a bill earlier today, people were noticing the lack of police support on the highways. And yeah, people in my community at least are beginning to notice the school crisis. Just a quick fact, the Hillsborough population grew over 86% according to the U.S. Census in the last decade. And having this local option, I know, is supported by my district and by many people in my community. I live in a new growth community myself as part of Hillsborough, and would ask you to please schedule a work session and give these bills a chance. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Conkling.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Gary Conkling, appearing today on behalf of the Beaverton and Hillsborough School Districts in support of Senate Bill 493. This bill is a little different than system development charges, which I'll explain in a moment. It is a school impact fee, but it would be an additional financial tool for schools to use to meet their capital facility needs. I think the rationale for any kind of a charge on new residential development is that it adds to the capacity in the community to generate more students that show up at public schools. And opponents sometimes will say the person that moves into a new house is moving from another house in the same community. And that often is, in fact, true. Nonetheless, the additional housing unit represents a capacity that can generate children that can require a new school or school additions or additions to an existing school. The key difference between Senate Bill 493 and a system development charge is that, in fact, the methodology here is that it is not a system development charge. Therefore, it's not subject to the same limitations, particularly those relating to proximity to the property. And for large districts in particular that have open enrollment or magnet schools, it's not an insignificant difference. The development of this particular methodology was worked out with local government officials several years ago, and I think is an important distinction. One other key distinction between 493 and other system development charges is that this would not be imposed at the point of a building permit, but rather at the time of a title transfer. The significance of that is that one of the opponents that developers make is that they have to bear the carrying costs, the carrying charges of the system development charge, and therefore also the interest costs. In this particular case, this fee would be imposed really more clearly on the ultimate occupant of a unit. This one has another feature in that it requires going through a county commission. Many people have objected to the fact that schools would do this without concern about a variety of issues, including affordable housing, and this bill has expressed provisions that relate to special needs housing as well as low-income housing. And I might just add for the record, because one of the questions will be is that, well, does this really generate very much money? Last year in the Beaverton School District, if this would have been in effect at the maximum amounts, there were 868 single-family dwellings and 338 multifamily dwellings, which would have generated $3.28 million. And to put that in proportion, the cost of land for a new elementary school is roughly that proportion. It's between about $2.5 and $3 million. A middle school site costs between $4 and $6 million, and a high school between $9 and $12 million. I might add that's if we could actually find them inside the urban growth boundary. For Hillsborough, the numbers are fairly similar. They would, in the last 2 years, 2 years ago, would have raised $2 million and $1.8 million last year. So it's not an insignificant amount of money. It's not enough to pay the entire price of building the new schools, but it's the kind of money that can come in. It can be very valuable for us to use to buy school sites, which often is a good idea to have before you build a school.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Mayor Dodds, didn't know you were here. Please come on up. Mr. Adams, Mr. Reed, and Mr. Winston, if you're here. And again, hoping to wrap this hearing up in 5 minutes. Afternoon.
Thank you very much, Chair Deckert, and thank you, Senators. My name is David Dodds. I'm the mayor of West Lynn, and I'll definitely honor your request. I think everything that has to be said has been said at this point. This is nothing new. SDCs are not new to Oregon. Growth impact fees for schools, police, fire are nothing new in the nation. What I would draw your attention to is a copy of a letter and a resolution that the city of West Lynn sent out late last year. We've sent letters to every city, every county, every school district, and every active county planning organization in Clackamas County, eliciting support for SDCs for schools, police, fire, and libraries. And you can see at the back of this is an up-to-date list of the positive responses that West Lynn has gotten to that letter. There are 27 cities, 3 school districts, 2 county planning organizations, the Oregon School Board Association, and on the issue of SDCs for fire, the Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue Special District, which serves over 400,000 people and is, I believe, the biggest special district in the state, who voted unanimously to support SDCs for fire. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 511. I think that the time for this has definitely come. The time, actually, this should have come earlier, but we can take things as they arrive. And I'd like to especially thank Senator Starr for introducing it, and as well as Senator Ringo and Senator Schrader, who I think spoke very eloquently in its defense. And with that, I'll turn the microphone over.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the Revenue Committee. Thank you for listening to us today. It's nice to hear so many people in favor of Senate Bill 511. My name is Chuck Adams. I live in West Lynn, Oregon. And since all my thunder's been stolen by the people before me, I'm just going to tell you the different hats that I wear and let you know that under each one of those hats, I have very good reasons to support this bill. I'm a businessman, a homeowner, a taxpayer, a youth sports advocate, and the outreach director for Alternatives to Growth Oregon. And under each one of those individually, I can see no reason whatsoever not to support this bill, given our financial times right now, given the dire needs of local communities, and given the fact that this is merely allowing communities to make choices. It's not forcing anything down their throats. I think it's imperative that we put this out on the floor of the Senate and give everyone a chance to vote on it. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for coming down.
Thank you, Chair Deckert, and thank you, committee, for hearing Senate Bill 511, and again, give us an opportunity to speak in favor of it. Just a couple points that I have.
We just need to get.
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm Richard Reed. I'm with Alternatives to Growth Oregon. I'm the lobbyist for the session for Alternatives to Growth Oregon. I provided written testimony that you can read later. I'm just going to hit a couple of high points here. One of them that hasn't quite been addressed is the real burden to communities is the financing of growth. If you take like $1 million worth of infrastructure in, say, a base year, if you finance that in 20 years in municipal bond that's going to be paid by property taxes, you start out with an initial bond payment of about $49,000. That'd be the taxpayer's share. Assuming a growth rate of 1.9%,
Well, at the end of 20 years, that $49,000 swells to $826,000, and the total of the payments, that would be the annual payment, swells to $826,000. The total of the payments over the 20-year period for $1 million worth of infrastructure is over $9 million. That's 187 times more than the first year's payment and nine times greater than the total cost of growth infrastructure in the baseline year. That's the big deal. That's part of why we're saying now communities are in such a critical situation now. That's why we haven't heard about it before, is that this amortization of the debt has just gotten larger and larger and larger, and it takes up community surplus, so they can't afford the amenities that communities usually want to provide. The other thing I think that hasn't been made clear is that SDCs really represent an important investment in the real estate industry itself and jointly in communities. SDCs assure that investments are made in the real estate market where it matters the most. SDCs help assure that a reasonable supply of developable land flows to the market. Also, SDCs for schools would help fill the need for one of the most sought-after real estate amenities, and that's schools. The same thing for streets. People come to a community, they want to know about the safety of the community and whether or not schools are funded. And then, as I mentioned before, with the funding of them, the present rules prevent sufficient investment in a reliable supply of infrastructure. That's simply the case. Senate Bill 511 is a good way to solve that problem. We really appreciate a work session on it, and let's get it to the floor so the full Senate can debate and discuss and pass it.
Thank you, Mayor. Mr. Winston, Mr. Stedman, Mr. Williams. Thank you. From a nice part of Beaverton.
Yeah. I'm Jeff Winston. I'm a parent, so I'm here speaking for myself. I live in the Beaverton area, and like some of the other speakers, I had a lot of things to say. Most of it's been said, so in order to be brief, the only thing I want to point out is I was thinking about this. When I was brought up, my mother taught me that if I went into a room and got a bunch of toys out or spilled some milk, I needed to take responsibility and clean up the mess that I left before I left the room. And for too many years, I've watched a lot of developers move into the Beaverton area, build out, make a profit, and leave, and leaving the mess, the school bill mess, for the rest of us to pay. And I think the time has come to hold the development communities start taking some responsibility for paying for the school messes that they've been leaving behind. Thank you.
That was brief. Thank you for coming down. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 493. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 511. And thank you, everyone, for coming down on those two bills. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 847. Whose bill is this? This is Matt Levin's.
It's just
Does Ringo want to talk on this?
No, he's not here.
He's not here. You're right. Matt, do you want to bring up your first panel? Whoever your first panel would be, Senator Ringo, if you want to, we'll give you maybe a 7-minute panel to speak about this. Six.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Ringo.
I mean, just my two cents on this pesticide use reporting is, we have a lot of very difficult budget decisions in this building session, and sometimes the decisions revolve around, do we pay for something that we want from the general fund, or do we pay for it from user fees? And from my perspective, I'm fine with the general fund, but if we can't get there, then I think we need to look at a user fee. Because it's vital to have pesticide use reporting. The only question is how we pay for it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. For the record, my name is Laura Weiss. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this afternoon. I'm here on behalf of OEC as well as the Northwest Coalition for Alternatives to Pesticides and OSPERG, who are partners in the Oregon Pesticide Education Network. Together, we represent over 28,000 Oregonians, and we urge you to support the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 847. I would say that in these times of financial difficulties, we have to spend our state resources wisely, and this bill would provide non-general fund dollars to support Oregon's landmark pesticide use reporting system. Despite the widespread use of pesticides and the subsequent environmental health benefit impacts, Oregon still has no information on which pesticides are used where, when, and what amounts. The 99 legislature passed by an overwhelming margin a law to collect this information. Unfortunately, the system intended to collect this information has been stalled because the legislature has failed to fund the program. Funding for this program, according to the 99 law, comes from a combination of registration fees paid by pesticide manufacturers and the state general fund. The law currently prevents the Department of Agriculture from spending registration fees on the program unless the legislature allocates an equivalent amount of money from the general fund. Given the state's financial problems, this approach to funding the program no longer makes sense. Several studies have shown that pesticides that are used in urban and suburban settings are a significant contributor to pesticide contamination of our water. For example, a recent U.S. Geological Survey of urban streams in the Seattle area found 23 different pesticides, including some that exceeded limits to protect aquatic life. The USGS concluded that pesticide use on lawns and gardens significantly contributed to this contamination. Meanwhile, thousands of Oregon retailers sell millions of pounds of pesticides to urban and suburban pesticide users without paying anything toward Oregon's pesticide tracking program. The Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 847 would require anyone who sells pesticides in the state of Oregon to pay an annual license fee. The fee would range from $25 to $150 a year and would be graduated based on the total revenue of the store. In this way, smaller stores would not have to pay as much as the major retail establishments, which we think would be fair. The revenue raised via this expanded fee, which would total roughly $1.2 million a biennium, would be dedicated to funding Oregon's pesticide use reporting system and would be sufficient to replace the general fund dollars currently allocated for the program. We've already invested more than $1 million into pesticide use reporting system. We believe it would be a waste of public resources to not provide funding to finish this program and allow it to work as currently written and established. And in these times of financial difficulties, a funding mechanism that doesn't rely on general fund makes a lot of sense. In closing, I just want to add that more than a dozen state and federal agencies have identified pesticide tracking as an important tool to protect public health, salmon, and water quality in Oregon. That's why we need to find a stable and sufficient source of funding for this program. We urge you to vote in favor of a Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 847. And I've also included with my testimony a salmon-colored sheet that lists 17 organizations that are supporting the pesticide tracking program and funding. And in fact, there was one or two left off, so it's more like 18 or 19. We'll fix that later.
Thank you.
Point of order, Mr. Chairman. The relating clause indicates this bill cannot originate in the Senate.
What's the bill number?
Senate Bill 847.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ringo.
Just to respond to that, we're allowed to impose a tax if there's a reasonable nexus to its use. And
no question, Mr. Chairman. Absolutely true.
Right.
Except tax bills requiring 3/5 majority vote cannot originate in the Senate. Sorry.
No, I disagree with that.
Yeah. I think we should take it up with legislative council.
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, we only have 5 minutes anyway, but I don't think he's right.
Paul, do you want to? My understanding is that any revenue raising bills do, if it increases the question, the pertinent question is, does it raise money for the state of Oregon? If it does, it has to.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with you. I've been trained to look for the words imposing a tax.
And those usually
have to originate, not usually. Constitutionally, they're required to originate in the House. And that's why I was curious about the Senate bill numbering, so I looked at the relating clause.
Yeah. That is my 3/5.
Does this still require 3/5?
Yes.
It says in the... I wonder how Dexter actually drafted the bill. I'm sure he's on his way. Can we have a public hearing on a bill that
Mr. Chairman, I think we cannot do any formal. I'm surprised we didn't get it signed to the committee.
Well, it's made it through several venues.
Incredible.
Paul, out one door. And
in one door.
And Paul went out. You came in and he went walked out. And I know, Dexter, you want to address this question? And if you could also include in the answer, can we have a public hearing on a bill that should originate in the House because of the frequency?
Mr. Chair, members, Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council Office. The answer to the question you just asked, can you have a public hearing on a bill that should originate in the House, the answer is yes.
Okay.
You can, in fact, introduce and pass bills that, under the Constitution, are required to originate in the House. They have a big defect in them, but you can go ahead and proceed to pass a bill that is required to originate in the House, even though it originates in the Senate.
Mm-hmm. And were the sponsors in the drafting of this, do you know, were the sponsors apprised of the constitutional difficulty that this bill had being a Senate bill? If you
well, Mr. Chair, communication between Legislative Council and the requester is confidential.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Corcoran and Senator Ringo.
I'll probably ask the same question. What? So if we follow that just a bit, we pass a bill with a fatal flaw in it over to the House. The House could, in its same form, pass it. Would it then come back to the Senate and then be corrected?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, if there was no changes in the bill, it would not come back to the Senate. It would go to the governor. And if the governor chose to sign it, it would become law, but would be subject to challenge in court.
Okay. You know, actually, Mr. Yates just, I think, made a really important point, is the dash ones, and Laura, you might want to comment on this, the dash ones might solve, is that's correct?
Mr. Chairman, I'd suggest that the relating clause cannot be modified, and if it's relating to taxation, even if you've gotten stuffed the bill, it's still relating to taxation.
Oh, that's not true. You could pass a bill.
Well, let's tax your answer. That's a good question.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Senator Ferrioli, the clause, I don't have the bill in front of me, but I believe the clause is relating to pesticides. Relating clause is actually only
relating
the clause.
Taxation of pesticides.
So the question is, can the public hearing is satisfied?
Mr. Chairman,
I apologize. I could have sworn it said relating to pesticides.
Mr. Chairman, I suggest that the bill has a number of proponents. Courtesy hearing certainly is in order, but I suggest we have we do this at the peril of violating our own rules of engagement.
Well, not
Mr. Chair,
Senator Ringo.
Thank you. I just would like clarification from Mr. Johnson. What the rule is on this. If it says relating to taxation, regardless of what's in the bill itself, but let's say that the relating clause says that, does that automatically require that the bill be on the House side?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, no. And in fact, there are dozens of bills, Senate bills, that say relating to taxation.
Okay.
The issue on origination is it a bill for raising revenue? And if it is a bill for raising revenue, that is a bill that must originate on the House side.
And Mr. Chair, when you say raising revenue, you're talking about funds that will flow into the general fund.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, it's not quite that simple. It's not just the general fund, because you could easily draft around that. It's if it is for general governmental purposes.
Okay, that's fine. But just to follow up, Mr. Chair. So. If the let's not talk about the relating clause for a minute. Let's talk about the language in the bill. If the bill imposes a charge, and those funds are directed to a program with some sort of reasonable nexus, is that permissible to start on the Senate side?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, yes.
Okay, and does that require 3/5?
No.
Not a fee.
That's a fee.
That's right. So. Mr. Chair,
well, I want to go ahead and do the hearing. I think we've gotten the answer that we're free to proceed, and we have very limited time to actually hear the witnesses.
Okay,
Senator Ringo.
No, that's fine. We can pursue it later.
Mr.
Thank
Chairman,
you.
Just to bring closure to this, I think the
Senator Fairley.
Issue for me isn't perhaps so much the idea that it's revenue raising, because it could be considered fee, absolutely,
right,
if there's a nexus, and I think the good Senator Ringo points that out. This would require a three-fifths majority, indicated by the relating clause. So I would just suggest that it helps as a litmus test to determine whether it's a revenue-raising measure or not. And revenue-raising measures must originate in the House. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for your vigilance to this issue. Thank you very much. Please proceed.
And you wanted the bill so bad. Now you can't have it.
This is why I went to law school for 3 weeks and said no. Mm-hmm. Triumph of process over content. My name is Will Newman. I am a farmer and the research and education director for Oregon's Sustainable Agriculture Land Trust. I reside in Canby, Oregon. Mr. Chair and Senators, I come at this probably from a slightly different direction than other people you will hear from, which is I come at it from the research standpoint. There are a lot of questions revolving around pesticides, the use of pesticides, their effects, where they go, and all of that. The problem from my standpoint as a researcher is we simply don't have the data to be able to examine the questions. They're important questions. Other people will probably testify as to why those are important questions. But from a scientist standpoint, if you don't have the data, there's no way to know. If you don't fund the program, we don't have the data. It's not the kind of data you can get some other way. It's not the kind of data that a company or even a university would be able to gather. It's only gatherable in a program like the legislature has passed. And the only way I can see to get it is to fund it. And the most reasonable way to fund it, particularly in these days when nobody wants to talk about taxation, is to have a user fee for it so that the people who are using the pesticides pay for the gathering of the information. And then we can do some valid scientific assessments and determine the answers to all of these questions that are going on that have to do with pesticides. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Witt.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Brad Witt, Oregon AFL-CIO, and I will attempt to summarize my comments as quickly as possible. Our labor federation has two primary interests in funding pesticide use reporting system here in the state of Oregon, and I should say that I'm appearing before you today in support of Senate Bill 847 and the -1 amendments. There are two things that we hope to get out of this pesticide use reporting. One was information that would help protect workers' safety and health, particularly in those instances where a so-called pesticide hotspot is established, and then subsequently we have workers that move into that area, and unbeknownst to them, there are pesticides that are in existence there, and by any stretch of the imagination, folks should be taking precautionary measures to avoid undesirable exposures. This would allow us, the information from this would allow us to design a set of protocols that would say that if you were working in the following areas, perhaps at certain times of the years under the following conditions, you might expect to have a pesticide exposure, and it would be worth your while to take the following kinds of precautionary measures. That's point number one. Point number two is our membership has a vested interest in trying to avoid the inflexibility of federally mandated recovery programs for threatened and endangered species. And to the extent that we can, through this pesticide use reporting, monitor the impacts of pesticides on threatened and endangered species and assure ourselves that these species are not being pushed over the threshold and that all the good efforts that many of our employers are expending to bring about the recovery of these species is not being undermined, then this is the kind of data that is exceedingly important to our membership. For those two reasons, we support this bill with the amendments and urge the committee to support it as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Starr.
I have a question. As the -1 amendments are drafted, it appears to me that you take out retail pesticide dealer from the requirements of the statute. Does that mean like the Home Depot or the Lowe's that sells pesticides would not have to pay this fee? Because you list from my reading of it, and I could be wrong. I read it quickly and trying to. I don't have the laws. I have the statute in front of me. But pesticide dealer, as defined in ORS 634, is ones that basically deal with restricted or highly toxic pesticides. Does that mean all pesticides, or those a special category of pesticides as opposed to the pesticides that are less regulated or restricted or less highly toxic?
I think I can address that, Chair Deckert. Senator Starr, we, in seeing these Dash 1 amendments for the first time today, have discovered that there are a couple of issues in here that don't necessarily reflect the intent. And one of those is kind of what you're talking about. There is an existing program in place whereby anyone who sells a restricted use pesticide has to pay a license fee, and those people are considered pesticide dealers. Some of that, the money that's collected from that program today helps to fund ODA's base pesticide program. The intent of these Dash 1 amendments are to broaden that net and include anyone who sells a pesticide in the state in this fee, license fee situation. So what we'd like to do is actually set up two different definitions. One would be a dealer, as currently defined, and they would continue to pay the fee that they pay today, perhaps an increased fee. The other would be this new pesticide retailer, so that all the stores in the state that are now not covered would be covered, and that new money would then go to pay for pesticide tracking.
Mr. Chair.
That makes sense.
And on page 8, it says it does not apply to any person who sells, offers for sale, handles, or distributes pesticide fertilizer mixtures in packages of 25 pounds or less. So is that possible that your neighborhood True Value store that's selling to to just retail customers in small amounts would not be regulated by this bill, would not have to pay these fees?
Chair Deckert, Senator Starr, I would have to take a closer look at that before I can answer that question accurately.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Brandis, Ms. Pyle, Ms. Wilkinson, Ms. Keith, do you want to? These are our four in opposition.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Paulette Pyle, I'm concerned about the Dash 1 amendments. It looks like it takes the whole bill apart, and we haven't read those. This is the first time we've seen them. So my testimony may not be applicable. The only concern I would have, members of the committee, is that when you read what Senator Farioli brought to your attention, which I didn't catch, good catch, Senator, imposes taxes on retail sales of pesticides, dedicates tax money to pollution reduction. Where did the pesticide use reporting thing come in? And if you read the original bill, unless it's changed in the Dash 31 amendments, and I can pass this out so you can have this before you. It's our attorney's contention and our contention that this bill, the Pollution Reduction Fund, is established separate and distinct from the general fund and the state treasury. And with the Pesticide Use Reporting Act, if that is indeed what they're intending this money for, which the bill doesn't designate that, you do have to have matching funds to the fees that are paid by the registrants has to come directly from the general fund. So I'm not sure how this would all work. You're right, we're opposed to the bill. But I think for us to do justice before the committee, we need to go back and look at the Dash 1s and bring that to your attention and maybe get the things straightened out that Senator Farioli brought forward. And then I guess if we're intending to use this for pesticide use reporting, which we kind of anticipated they were going, but that's not what the bill says. And I think they would have trouble bringing that together.
It's not a regulating class for the bill.
And, I would say, my feeling based on the point that Senator Farioli brought at the beginning of the meeting is this is a bill that would have to originate.
It's confusing. If,
the bill itself, so.
Super. And, again, the testimony I passed out may or may not apply because the Dash 1 amendments, I hadn't heard about until Senator Starr said something. So thank you very much.
Ms. Wilkinson.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jean Wilkinson. I'm representing the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. We also oppose Senate Bill 847, but again, I haven't seen the Dash 1 amendments or read them, so I don't know what it does now. But we generally are skeptical about additional costs that would we would expose farmers to on the already exorbitant costs of producing farm commodities in the state. I am a partner with my parents in a family farm operation that's existed since the turn of the century. and one of our biggest costs is the cost of chemicals. We spend $50,000 to $75,000 a year on chemicals, and any additional taxes that are imposed on retail sellers of distributors of pesticides would be directly coming to us and actually paid by the farmers. And so we're skeptical about that. Not that we don't support pollution control. We're big advocates of additional research for pollution control, but an additional tax that would be paid by our agriculture community would be detrimental. Now, I don't know, again, as Paulette pointed out, how this relates to the pesticide use reporting program. The fact of the general funds being used to pay for that was a deal that was brokered amongst the agriculture community when that bill was passed. So this would be a change of policy that would need to be negotiated amongst the agriculture community if they're going to, in fact, pay the entire cost of the program rather than what was the deal that was made before. So there's lots of questions hanging out there, and again, we oppose the bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, Julie Brandis with Associated Oregon Industries and its Retail Council. Retail Council is about 500 retail members that belong to AOI and include some of our nation's largest retailers. We are opposed to Senate Bill 847. Pesticides aside, we really oppose specialty product taxes. There are a lot of causes that are worthy of both general fund dollars and special fee dollars or special product tax dollars. And it often puts retailers in an awkward position of debating both the cause that the money is intended to go to and also the tax. And already this session on the House side, we've had a fight against a retailer paid or a retail tax on video games. And that money would have gone to another cause for children that I'm sure is very worthy of state dollars. We really could end up sales taxing individual products to death and putting the retailers in an awkward position of collecting individual taxes that go to general fund causes. So I think you could see the problems that retailers face if this legislature starts trying to fund products programs this way by individually taxing products and then causing retailers to force a point of sale tax at the time of purchase. So those are some of our concerns.
Thank you. Thank you. Ms. Keith.
Sorry.
Oops. The only two left are Dr. Harris. Dr. Harris, are you here? He's not here. You get close for us, Ms.
Okay, I will, and I will be brief, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your patience.
Yes, and thank you for yours. I'm here representing the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association, and I'm speaking in opposition to Senate Bill 847 and was prepared to speak in opposition to the original bill. I've had a chance to glance at the Dash 1 amendments, and I believe they're less onerous, perhaps, than the original bill, but I'm quite sure I'm safe in saying that veterinarians would also oppose the Dash 1 amendments in their practice as retail sellers of pesticides across the counter to their clients. The flea and tick control medications fall into this category. They got cut by the pesticide use reporting bill, sort of unbeknownst to them last session, and are just real anxious not to get caught any further.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 847. Adjourn Senate Revenue Committee.